Welcome in to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. We have a very interesting, compelling show for you this Tuesday, and want to set it up by setting the scene for you, if you will. I just over the weekend read a very compelling book. I'm using the word compelling a lot, but there's a reason for that. Want to set the scene for you as this, as a concerned parent, maybe a concerned person of the family who's had a nightmare scenario dropped in your lap. And I'll put the nightmare scenario as this. We've all at one time or another been in charge of children. We've had them by our sides. And the worst scenario you can think of is what would happen if that child were to all of a sudden disappear, never to be seen again. Better yet, what if you were that young adult that was out there and you had that overwhelming, powerless feeling of being taken by someone, never to be seen again? Been in that position where you were overpowered, struggling, trying to fight for your life. Who would fight for you? Who would try to get you justice? Who would try to clear up the story of your end? And who would try to vindicate you if there were so many people out there trying to tell your story that knew nothing about you, who put out false rumors, who put out false stories? And would you be surprised if it was just a random stranger that related to you? I say that for this reason, because there's a book out there, brand new book, that I really did have an amazing experience with this weekend. I really related to it, and it's a fascinating read. LaDonna Humphrey is our guest. She's a writer, documentarian, investigative journalist, private investigator, and an advocate for victims of crime. For the past 6 years, LaDonna has found herself passionately entangled in seeking justice for Melissa Witt, who is the subject of our book today. In her pursuit of justice for Melissa, Humphrey has co-produced the documentary Uneven Ground, the Melissa Witt story, to be released later this year, and is in contact with Genius Books for the book The Girl I Never Knew, which is the book we'll talk about today. LaDonna Humphrey lives in Cave Springs, Arkansas, with her husband and five of her seven children who are still at home. So let's welcome in to True Crime Tuesday, LaDonna Humphrey. Hi, LaDonna.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
I got to tell you, LaDonna, when I sat down with this book, I was drawn in right away. And the reason I was drawn in right away is because the connection isn't made right away as to why you so strongly or felt so strongly for Melissa Witt in her case. And eventually you tie the pieces together. But you know what I want to do here? If I may, LaDonna, if I can we tell people why you're so strongly attached to this case?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's probably the question that I'm asked the most. And the answer is simple and complicated, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really because, you know, I didn't know Melissa. You know, the book is, you know, The Girl I Never Knew, but I have a lot of mutual friends in common. You know, I had a similar experience growing up at a bowling alley where a man tried to abduct me. And then I think you tie all that together with, you know, becoming an advocate later in life for missing persons cases, and then tackling the Melissa Witt case and being out at the location where her body was discovered, really cinched it for me. I knew that I had to, I knew I had to get her justice.
You know, in the book, it's so your experience, and your sister was with you, correct? At this bowling alley, you'd went to watch your father bowl. And was it a weekly thing where you and your sister had gone to watch your father?
Yes, he was on a league, and we went almost every week. But, you know, it was something that we looked forward to do with him. And, you know, we lived in a small town and there wasn't a lot to do. And so when we got the opportunity, it was something fun for us as kids.
So you go to watch your father you had described it almost as a time of innocence, and it is at that age, at the age you were at that time, it's a time of innocence. I remember going to watch my grandparents bowl And one of the favorite things was not only the fact that grandma would stack up quarters for us to go play the video games, but there was also going to a place called Little Brooklyn to go eat afterwards. And I think we all have fond memories of bowling alleys. And I think anyone of a certain age has a fond memory of a bowling alley. And I think what shakes you about reading this book is you'll never look at bowling alleys the same again when you read this book. Bowling alleys really are, I guess for lack of a better term, kind of skeevy, aren't they? After you read this book?
They are. When you think about it, I mean, I remember as a kid being excited, you know, you like the loud music and it's the, you know, the atmosphere, the smell of popcorn, you know, the kids running around, the crashing of the pins, you know, that's exciting. It's really stimulating for a kid, but it's really not a safe place for a kid to be even now. I mean, even then. So skeevy is a good word. I would agree with you.
So you're there with your sister and you described the smell of popcorn, like you said, and there's hamburgers in the air, and it really was a time of innocence. I remember my time of innocence there. Like you said, we were running around, we're having a good time. And then something happens where a man comes in and he claims he knows your father. Would you describe that for our audience as to how that scene set up and why it seems so trusting? I really feel like this is something that our audience needs to learn about. And then there's a website that I want you to point out to people as to where they need to go to get more information on this.
You know, to set it up, you know, kind of like what I mentioned before, it was a time of innocence. We lived in a very, very small town in Oklahoma. So we're there and you think that you know everybody. But that's not always the case. You know, you've got surrounding towns and, you know, people come and go, but, you know, I'm there that night. You know, my dad feels safe. You know, we've been there before and, you know, he gives us the money to put in our pockets. We go buy something from the concession stand. And shortly after I made that purchase, as we're going to our seat, a man crashed into me. At the time, I thought it was an accident. But he purposely ran into me to knock the popcorn out of my hand. And I think, you know, that was the first step in, I think, probably what his routine was as a predator. Because if I would have responded in such a way to allow him to buy me some more popcorn, you know, that's that first little bit of trust that he's gained. But I didn't. I was very leery because I didn't know him. So, you know, I go ahead and go to my seats. I tell him, no, thank you. You know, I'm a little nervous that this has happened. And he sits near my sister and I so he can talk to us and have a conversation, but not so close that other adults that are bowling would think that he's talking to us. He was really sly. He was really slick. And he just eventually wore us down talking about how he knew my dad. You know, I get a little bit emotional thinking about it now. You know, I remember him specifically saying to me when my dad turned to wave at my sister and I, the man specifically said, "See, I told you he'd be glad to see me tonight." And I automatically, as a kid, believed that he had waved at us and that man. And so it went. He really just, you know, built some trust with me that night because he sat there so openly talking to me. At some point in the evening, after he's had these conversations, he's talking about he'd gone on this fishing trip with my dad. My dad leaves his lane. I don't notice it, but he leaves the lane to go to the restroom. And the man who was a predator, and I, in the book, I call him the man with the dark beard, because that still stands out in my mind. Mm-hmm. He took that opportunity to say, "Okay, I told you about that fishing trip. I've got this fish in the car, this huge fish that my dad, you know, you and me and your dad caught. Let's go look at it." And I really wanted to see it because my dad was a fisherman. He loved fish. And, you know, long story short, my sister was whining and I ended up telling her she could come with us. The man takes my hand. He gets me to the door of the breezeway in the bowling alley. And that's when my world is wrecked because I hear my dad scream, "Stop, stop right there." And it just chaos ensued after that. The man took off running. Other people start chasing after him. The music stops. You know, my sister wets her pants. It was a delayed reaction for me by the time I screamed, when I really realized that something bad was going on. You know, and this was in the 80s. It was before, you know, you really understand what an adverse childhood experience is and what childhood trauma is. And it was years before I actually understood how that trauma impacted my life. But, you know, it can happen to anybody, and it almost happened to us.
And you say it took years to realize what this trauma did to you. When is it in your life? And I know this really is and isn't about you, but I want to show people how exactly this forms into your persona and how this helps you attach to Melissa Witt. When is it that you finally start to realize how badly this trauma affected you? What age is it that you finally go, you know what? I really am a changed person. Had this never happened to me, I might have been a different person.
You know, I was in my late 30s, early 40s, and I was standing on a logging road in the Ozark National Forest when investigators took me out there, you know, years after Melissa's body was found, to the crime scene. And I remember standing out there, and I was very overwhelmed, but memories of that bowling alley immediately came crashing down. And, you know, leaving there and then kind of diving into Melissa's case over the next few months is when that heaviness set in for me, and I realized how truly traumatized I had been as a child and had not dealt with that trauma, and how it subsequently had affected me. So I actually started therapy after that, because it became a recurring dream. It became something that started overshadowing my thoughts as I was working on the Witt case. And, you know, the fact that my story ended so differently than hers, you know, it's hard to deal with sometimes. And, you know, I've had to process that. And that's one of the motivating factors that I have to get justice for her.
Well, and I realize that that's a motivating factor. But the one thing I do have to ask you, LaDonna, is how do you keep from getting swallowed up by that trauma during this process as you're investigating this case? To me, there's a fine line between putting on a brave face and trying to get justice for Melissa and trying not to fall into this chasm of grief and hysteria almost and reliving that childhood experience. I mean, there's a fine line. There's some things that we'll go over here in the book that to me would seem like it would instantly bring you back to either your own experience or put you into a downward spiral of just despair.
You know, for me, when I recognized that trauma had impacted my life in that way and that I had not addressed it the way I should have, and I don't blame anybody. You know, like I said, my parents didn't understand childhood trauma back then. And I am by and large a pretty resilient person. But when I realized that this was having such a negative impact on me, I immediately went to counseling. And the reason I did that is because I have 5 children that I've adopted out of the foster care system. Mm-hmm. And I understand childhood trauma. I understand adverse childhood experiences. And I could parallel that to, this is what I'm doing to help my own children. I need to do this for myself. And so I did. And so through that process, it's really helped me. It's helped me understand myself and decisions that I've made and my lack of trust. But it's also helped me understand my advocacy, because I've always been an advocate, you know, for whether it be children in foster care, you know, the missing, you know, women in recovery, those types of things. So that's really what's helped make this a positive experience for me. And I've just taken what I've learned and I'm channeling that into positive things. What I can do to get Melissa Witt justice, what I can do to help keep other people safe. And that's working for me. You know, it may not work for everybody, but I feel like I'm addressing it. I recognize it, and I'm going to do something about it.
As a side note, and we'll move on from this experience. You do mention in the book that this was extremely traumatizing to not just your mother, but your father as well. And that he was extremely traumatized that this incident had happened on his watch, so to speak. How did he end up dealing with this over the years?
You know, I'm not really sure. That's the odd thing, is because we've just not really talked about it. It's not something that we continue to talk about as a family. You know, we addressed it in the very beginning when it occurred, and then it was like we didn't address it anymore. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if that's just because we came from a generation where we didn't understand it, and so you just try to move forward the best that you can. I don't know. I mean, and I don't mean that critical towards the adults in my life at all. I just think you don't know what you don't know.
Right, right. And you're right. That is that generation. I didn't know whether he had finally come forward and said, you know, I feel real guilt from that day, or, you know, I finally found a way to deal with it, or, you know, that generation has different ways of dealing with what they dealt with, or if it you know, manifested itself in some other way or what. I was just curious. So let's move on here, LaDonna. Let's talk a little bit more here about Melissa Ann Witt and exactly how you get involved with this case. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the circumstances of Missy Witt and what exactly happened on that fateful day and who exactly Missy Witt is.
So people ask me all the time who Missy Witt is. And, you know, that's something that I really, it's important to me that people remember her, because, you know, she was only a murder victim this small amount of time in her life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was so much about her. You know, she was 19. She was a college student. She went to church every Sunday. She didn't have any enemies. She got good grades. She was fun loving. She loved her mom. She loved her family, her friends, her community. Just an amazing, innocent young woman who had these dreams to be a dental hygienist. She was boy crazy, like anybody is at age 19, and just had, you know, an amazing life and had big plans for herself. And so that was who Melissa Witt was. She was attending a community college in Fort Smith. At the time, it was called West Ark Community College. She was also employed as a dental assistant at a local dental office. And, you know, on December 1st, it was a Thursday. It started off pretty normal. She woke up to get ready for school. It just so happened she and her mom had a small argument about money. Melissa had asked to borrow money. Her mom said, no, you know, you're getting paid tomorrow. I'm trying to teach you money management. The answer is no, Melissa. And so Melissa went on with her day. She went to class. She went to lunch with a friend. She went to work. She had a little bit of car trouble after work, got that taken care of, went home, found a note from her mom that said, hey, don't forget, tonight's league night. I'm bowling. Why don't you come on out? I know we argued. I love you. Come on out and I'll buy you a hamburger. So we know Melissa made it to the bowling alley, but she never made it inside. Investigators believe that somebody was waiting for her at that bowling alley. An argument ensued. Which led to Melissa being hit in the head with some sort of object. We don't know exactly what it was. Would have made, you know, her head bleed pretty substantially, perhaps even knocked her unconscious. And at that point, that person made a decision to load Melissa up in a car, a Bronco, a van, a truck. We don't know. And he drove her 60 miles away to the Ozark National Forest, where he then, we believe, sexually assaulted her and strangled her to death, which is just, it's terrible. It was, you know, Melissa didn't come home. Her mom didn't know what was going on. It wasn't like Melissa. She called law enforcement the next morning, and the, you know, patrolman came out, didn't take it real seriously because, you know, it's not illegal to go missing as an adult or to take off because they'd had an argument that Thursday morning. Mm-hmm. And so it was really Sunday before the major crimes unit knew that this 19-year-old girl was missing, and they got boots on the ground and they found her car at bowling alley. at the bowling alley, and they searched for her for 45 days before she was eventually discovered in the Ozark National Forest.
Now, in a lawsuit that happens a little bit later, it was Missy's mom that actually points out that the bowling alley didn't have proper security on the night of Missy's murder. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. They did employ a security company. And at that time, you know, it's the 90s, it's the mid 90s. And of course, there was petty crime that happened, but nothing like this had ever happened in Fort Smith. And they had security every other day, every few days. And it just so happens on that Thursday, December 1st, there was no security. The parking lot wasn't well lit. No security cameras. I mean, it was just a perfect storm for somebody who was, you know, ripe and ready to abduct a young girl.
And isn't there an issue with her keys? Something about her keys?
Yeah, that. So with her keys, we were able to, I say we, but investigators were able to establish a timeline because a gentleman and his family came to the bowling alley around 7:30-ish that night and found a set of keys in the parking lot, which nobody knew at the time had small flakes of dried blood. You know, the blood was drying. He turned the keys into the front desk, and it just so happens those were Melissa Witt's keys. The bowling alley discovered that the following Monday or Tuesday in their lost and found bin and called investigators and said, "Hey, I think we have Melissa Witt's keys," because, you know, the keychain said Missy. Mm-hmm. And so that really was able to help investigators set up a timeline of when she, you know, when we believe she arrived and when the argument ensued based on some witnesses and then, you know, the keys being found. So that was helpful, but it was also frightening because now they knew the race was on. You know, they had to find out where Melissa was and what had happened.
There may be a lot of people that read this book who may say, well, of course, in Fort Smith, Arkansas, they have to have DNA testing, right? So they tested those keys with DNA right away, took the dried blood off the keys, and it was all solved, right?
I wish. I think that, you know, we all wish that. But unfortunately, you know, we were just then seeing the rise of DNA. Mm-hmm. You know, it existed, but, you know, we weren't seeing it being used like we do today. I mean, the O.J. Simpson case was, you know, at the height. And so we were learning about it. But no, there was no testing for those keys. We believe that was Melissa Witt's blood on those keys. But still, that put us, you know, at a disadvantage in her case.
Yeah, correct. So you have this information and tell us now where you come into the scenario. So, and this is kind of interesting. So they find her 45 days afterwards, and they found her naked out in Ozark National Forest, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I guess I put that in there because and I know you don't like to talk about the details of this. I should mention this for our audience because they haven't read the book. But the reason why we don't give too many scant details about Missy's condition is because out of respect, for lack of a better term, isn't that correct, LaDonna?
It is. It's really important to me that her memory is honored in such a way that, you know, obviously I wrote a book about true crime. But I think you can also do that in a very tasteful way. So correct. I try to be very protective of her memory.
Right. So there's evidence here saying that certain things were done to her post-mortem. We can put it that way, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So there's a point here where as you're reviewing the case, you decide to get involved. And as you pointed out, there were some friends in common. At one point, you decide to make a documentary. Can you kind of walk us through what was behind the documentary and why you decided to make that?
Yes. So I had co-founded an organization that was about a decade and a half old. And, you know, by the time 2015 hit, it wasn't really, we weren't really relevant anymore. The database NamUs was on the scene. It was funded by the federal government, and they could do everything we were doing better and funded by the federal government. And so, you know, our agency that was assisting families and law enforcement with missing adult cases really wasn't going to be as needed. And we don't believe in duplicating services. So what we decided to do as an agency is to kind of finish off the good work that we had done with a documentary that covered, you know, maybe one or two or more missing persons cases. And this is where it becomes pretty interesting, because here I am, I live in Arkansas. Many of my team members live in Arkansas, and everybody kept saying, we ought to look at the Witt case, the Melissa Witt case. And I would say, no, her body was discovered. She's not missing. It doesn't fit our criteria. The answer is no, we're not going to do a documentary about Melissa Witt. And I was actually pretty passionate about not following her case. But the team sort of outvoted me and talked me into contacting the Fort Smith PD, which I did, and we scheduled a meeting. They had already known who we were. They had worked with our nonprofit agency before. So there was a little bit of, you know, a level of trust there. And so I went and met with some of the retired detectives on Melissa's case. And that's when it was just clear to me that we had to do something for Melissa's case, because these seasoned detectives were emotional, and visibly impacted by the fact that they hadn't been able to solve her case. And their passion and the amount of courage that they had shown in this case and the amount of care that they showed for Melissa and her family completely captured my attention and my heart. And that's really what inspired me to get involved. And the deeper I dug in, the more passionate I became about Melissa's case. So isn't that ironic? You know, eventually, at first I said no, but then, you know, here I am 7 years later, probably the most outspoken advocate for Melissa Witt.
And you know what? Let's take our break here, because I want to talk about one of those detectives. In fact, he's the former lead detective on the Melissa Witt murder investigation. We'll talk about him when we come back, and how exactly this former lead investigator changed LaDonna's life. LaDonna Humphrey is our guest. And the book that we're talking about is The Girl I Never Knew, and it's available right now. In fact, we have a link to it in the description of this program. The Girl I Never Knew, Who Killed Melissa Witt? LaDonna Humphrey is our guest right here on True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is LaDonna Humphrey. The book is The Girl I Never Knew, Who Killed Melissa Witt? We have a link to the book right in the description of this program. Go ahead, click on that link and get yourself a copy right now. Let's talk about the, we teased it before the break, one of the lead, the lead investigator in the Melissa Witt case kind of changed your life. His name is J.C. Ryder. And you had teased before the break that these investigators who were so passionate about this case when you were making the documentary kind of changed your direction and how you would pursue basically the next 7 years of your life. Tell me a little bit about J.C. Ryder and what it was about J.C. That made you change your mind about pursuing Melissa Witt's case.
You know, when I first met J.C. Ryder, and I write about this, I mean, he just oozes tough guy. You know, I'm tough, I'm intimidating, I'm all serious. And it was very unnerving to meet him. He was very polite, but he was also skeptical because, you know, he'd worked so hard for so many years to solve the case. And now we've got somebody that wants to do a documentary. You know, how much do they know and how much are they willing to, you know, work to tell the story the right way? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was interesting. And so the more I got to know J.C. Ryder, the more I learned that, you know, even though he's tough and intimidating, he's really got a heart of gold. And he truly, truly is so, you know, devastated, I think is the is a fair word, that he's not been able to bring closure to Melissa's case, because, you know, he feels the same way I do. She deserves justice. She was 19 years old. What happened to her was absolutely horrific. He got to know her mother very well and promised Marianne that he would never give up until he was able to find out who killed Melissa Witt. And so we built a friendship, a real unlikely friendship, based on that desire to solve this case. And on top of that, you know, he's really taken the time to teach me everything that I need to know and then some about the case, but how to handle, you know, other investigations. And, you know, he was part of the inspiration for me to become a private detective and to continue to do the things that I'm doing. So really huge impact on my life. I talk to him almost every day, at least through text message. I have ultimate respect for him and for Chris Boyd, for the amount of work and dedication they put into this case and just how they protected and served the River Valley. There are many, many cases they worked outside of the Witt case, and they've worked all of them, you know, very passionately. So, you know, he's a dear friend of mine, and I'm just very grateful that I've had the opportunity to learn from him and to walk alongside him on this journey to get Melissa justice.
As you start to kind of weave your way into Melissa's case, JC becomes even more integral into your case, because you really do get thrown a lot of false leads. And a lot of, as you start to open things up to the public to try and get this case warmer. And we should mention, you opened up a Facebook page. And by the way, is that Facebook page still active?
It is. It's very active. It's simply Who Killed Missy Witt, really easy to find. We opened that in October of 2015. We have roughly about 14,000 people that follow it on a regular basis, but we've had over 3.8 million shares of information that we've put out there in the past 7 years. So it's a very active page, and it's been a huge tool in the Witt case.
You've had a lot of people come forward and throw a lot of falsities your way, for lack of a better term. And JC really was integral in helping you separate that, wasn't he? Tell us a little bit about the things he taught you in order to get you to separate fact from fiction.
You know, one of the things that happened during the course of this case is a situation that I write about, and it's about a woman that I call Sandy Jones. And Sandy was our introduction to what happens in cold cases. And I know it's not just Melissa's case, but, you know, for whatever reason, she's tried to interject herself into the case. She's tried to interject, you know, fiction as fact, called in false leads, you know, emailed them, and just really otherwise been kind of a thorn in our side, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I've really had to learn that I just didn't know how to handle it in the beginning is that, you know, you have to really set back and look at, these are the facts that I know. These facts are not movable. We know this, 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 and this. And so you have to look at these tips that come in, and you have to compare them to what you know that is absolutely definitively what happened. And so that helps kind of weed out some of those. But also, you know, what kind of manpower is it going to take to investigate this lead? You know, what kind of research are we going to have to do? What's already been done? Going to look back at the case files. And so there was just a lot of things that he taught me. You know, you can't just run with every single thing that everyone calls in, even if it sounds great. And he just really, you know, I liken it to, he's taught me how to play a game of chess in a murder case almost. And really, you know, take note of what's important, what to look for in a lead based on what we know about Melissa's case, because there is information that we've held back. There is information that the law enforcement is not going to share with the public. And we have that information too. And so that helps us determine leads that come in and how we share those and in what order with law enforcement. Because, you know, I kind of write about, you know, we've got this unlikely marriage between advocate and law enforcement, because our page for the Witt case has brought in information they never had before in Melissa's case, verifiable information. And so you know, they have to be able to trust us to do the right thing with that information and to share, you know, the right information on the Facebook page. So, you know, he's taught me how to work with, you know, other detectives. He's taught me how to share information and hold my cards, you know, closely to my chest, and how to, you know, give a compelling interview or write a compelling story without giving a lot of information either. So he's just, you know, JC Ryder has taught me so much, and I'm just really, really honored. And I hope that this work that we've done together will eventually, you know, bring some closure to her case, because I know he wants that so very much.
The following question is just speculation here, LaDonna, but do you feel that JC's motives weren't just professional, but also personal? Do you feel like maybe the reason why he brought you into the fold was not only that he could trust you, but that he knew that there was this case is so complicated that he was going to need a successor to pick up this case and go with it, that it was going to take more than just his generation and maybe even the next generation to solve this thing?
I think so. I think he sees the value and the wisdom in using new tools and technology, such as social media and those type of things that I'm very well versed in, that, you know, the department's not using, you know, to the, you know, they have social media, but they don't use it to the level we have. So yeah, I think by the time we started bringing in some pretty hefty information to him, mm-hmm. he was like, okay, this is going to work. Because, you know, I write about this in the book, you know, at one point I realized that I've been contacted by somebody who has been lying to me in the Witt case. And so I call JC and I give him this person's name, and he was like, okay, hold on a second. And that's somebody that he hadn't even talked to me about yet, right? Because he was still holding his cards pretty close.
Yep.
And so to know that that person was communicating with me, he began to see the value in the work that we were doing. And that really opened up, you know, I think I say it in the book, you know, a decades old murder case kind of explodes with new potential. And that's exactly the moment that I think he realized that this was going to impact Melissa Witt's case and perhaps get her justice.
I think, too, you hit whole new levels of respect with him in that you were willing to go to places that maybe other investigators weren't willing to go. And I'll touch on that here in a moment, because there's a disturbing chapter in the book that we'll talk about here in a few moments. We'll brush over it. We won't go too deep into it, but we'll brush over it because it's an interesting chapter that I'd like people to read for themselves. One of the things that touched me about the book, in one of the chapters that I can feel the relation between you and Melissa, is, you know, you pore over case files over and over and over again. And one of the things in those case files is Missy's diary. And there's a point where you take out your diary and her diary and you line them up and you find out where you were at 19 versus where she was at 19. And there's similarities and differences. And it's intriguing. It's intriguing to see where you were at 19 versus where she was at 19. But to see where you two line up and where you separate is everything in this book. Talk to me about kind of your MO as to why at that moment you did that. Why at that moment you felt like you had to relate on that level?
You know, I think the best way to explain that is because I really struggled with reading her personal thoughts, even though she's deceased. And even though law enforcement gave me permission, that was her personal thoughts and feelings. And I struggled with that because I know what my diary meant to me at 19, 20, 21. You know, that's very personal. And you don't want other people to read it. But I also know that based on my own diary, you know, the amount of raw emotion that you will share, and I knew that I had done some of the same thing. And some of it's funny and silly, but I also knew that there were some comparisons that I wanted to make because we're so close together in age, right? And I mean, I'm a little bit older than Melissa. And as it turned out, you know, we had written five of the last entries at the same time, the same day. And that just really kind of like blew me away because we are so, our paths ended so differently, right?
Yeah.
And, I think that's important for the reader to understand because that was also very pivotal for me to see how much alike we were. We both kept a journal, pretty naive, raised kind of the same way. And our stories ended so differently. You know, mine hasn't ended. I still have my story still being told, but hers ended so abruptly. And, I struggled. Somebody asked me yesterday, I did an interview yesterday, and somebody asked me what was the hardest chapter that I wrote in the book. And it would have been Diary Confessions, because those emotions that come up with, I'm reading her last words just days before she's murdered. It's hard to digest, and it's hard to accept that, her life was taken by somebody that had no right to do so. I mean, he just completely altered the course of her family and friends and a whole entire community's lives. And I find that utterly horrific and disgusting. And I want him to pay for that. And I think that if other people had that opportunity to read her diary, they would feel the same way. I mean, reading it and seeing that innocence and how naive she was, talking about, holding hands with the boy. She'd done little more than even kiss a boy, just that kind of innocence. And imagine that kind of innocence that was approached in a dark bowling alley parking lot on December 1st, how she would not have been able to handle that situation very well.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, I get very emotional thinking about what she must have gone through. And I learned that based on that diary. So, yeah, I mean, there was so much about us that was alike and our outlook on life was alike, but then there was just so much that was also different. So, it's just an important part of this journey, and it's a difficult part of the journey too. So, I'm very raw and emotional in that chapter. And I think the readers will see that. And I hope that they will be able to feel as incensed as I do.
Yeah. You can feel it. You can feel it. It comes off the page when you read that chapter. Not just the empathy for that situation, but you can really feel that you've put yourself in her shoes. And, that's one of the more powerful chapters in the book, and that's why I bring that up is that you can tell exactly why you took up this cause in that chapter alone. If there was very little story in the beginning, very little story at the end, that chapter alone exactly shows your big heart, your good heart, and your compassion in that chapter right there. I alluded to earlier, LaDonna, that you were thrown a lot of different false leads, but you also went to places I think that JC was, or maybe even was astounded to know that you would go to. I want to address one of them right now if I can, and it's a very dark place, and it's one that I don't think many of our audience members even know about. If you'll bear with me here, if we can just spend a couple of minutes on the world of necroporn. The reason why I brought up that she was found naked in the Ozark National Forest is the fact that you followed a lead. And if you could tell me a little bit about this lead, or tell our audience a little bit about this lead and where it led to, please. And just tell us why we're going in this direction.
Well, it's honestly difficult to talk about, but I had a lead that came in that really knocked my socks off. I can tell a little bit more about it now. I've been a little bit more open about it in my last two interviews, but this particular woman had been a model and had done some films in a certain area of the United States that I can't talk about, but she had been asked to pretend that she was dead in this film and wear a Mickey Mouse watch. And her sister really encouraged her to come forward, you know, and let us know. And so we at first didn't know how to take that lead because, I mean, necro porn, come on. I don't look at regular porn. So I just the whole idea was just very disgusting to me. And so with the blessing of law enforcement and help from an IT specialist and had the proper, you know, things in place, I really did delve into this world of necroporn, and mainly not just looking at the pornography really, but going into the forums where they discuss the pornography that they're making. So it's really more me looking at these discussions and finding out who the major players were and doing a deep dive into research. And what I found is that there were some movies being made that pretty darn well could be made after some real crime, including Melissa Witt's murder. And so that was intriguing to me, and I felt like I needed to chase that all the way down. And there's a lot more to say on that. And I'm releasing a second book just on that.
Wow. Okay.
Because there is more to say. And it's something that we're still investigating. I've tried to back away from some of it a little bit just to try to get some serenity in my life, because that's a pretty dark, terrible place to go to. And, you know, there's about 100,000 people in the world at any given time that are into that kind of fetish. You know, it's called death fetish. And out of that 100,000 people, you know, we believe 10% of those could be real killers.
Yikes.
And that's kind of mind-boggling to know that that's going on. And so, yeah, it's been difficult. And I still think that there might be, you know, a worthy connection to continue to look into. So, like I said, that's ongoing. And I struggled with whether I was going to put that chapter in the book or not, because that opens me up for a lot, because, you know, the people are going to know that I've been doing the investigation. But it was time to say it publicly and to kind of open the door to the public to know that that kind of thing is happening, so we could put a stop to it.
Well, it was an important chapter in that you tied a lot of things together. You even cite in the book that even Ted Bundy, who has got to be one of our more famous serial killers out there, was addicted to porn and had to escalate higher and higher and higher in his addiction. And that it only went so far. And then we've entered this new realm, which for our audience that isn't familiar, necroporn is basically, to my understanding, I've never viewed it, but my understanding from reading the book is basically going through the act of killing someone and then having sex with the dead body. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible, horrible fetish. But then the people who back, supposedly in the forums, from what you've described here, LaDonna, the people in the forums say, well, it's fantasy is all it is. And according to one person in the forum, they said it's no different than Disney.
Oh, it's no different than Disney. They will compare it to, you know, any mainstream, you know, like movie, and it's horrific. And there's a lot of these movies that are based on strangulation. A lot of them, one particular person that we're looking at pretty closely, I mean, his films, it's unnerving how similar it is to the murder of Melissa Witt, but some other murders that are very similar to Melissa. So, you know, is he basing that on real crime? I don't know. Has he committed real murders? You know, we don't know. But I would want to say this, and I didn't include that, this little bit that I'm going to tell you in the book. Mm-hmm. But as we're, you know, I've got a partner that's researching this with me, and we're delving deep into this dark world. Some of my information got leaked. And so one of the screen names who goes by Horror Man, he found me in real life. And so that's been kind of frightening. But because he found me and they kind of did some research on me and they realized who I am and this, you know, quest I'm on for justice, two of those necroporn sites shut down.
Oh, good.
And they cite the work that I've been doing. that tells me everything I need to know, that we have to dig deeper. Because even if for whatever reason this isn't connected to the Witt case, there's some real bad things that are happening within that community, and we need to shine a light on it.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I never thought I would be taking up that platform. But here I am. And you know, like I said, I have more to say on that. We've got a whole nother book that's coming out.
Well, good, good. And again, we look forward to when it comes out. We'd love to have you back when you release that book, because
it's definitely a big light
needs to be shown on that as well. So again, you've gone into these different, and there's so many different false leads that got thrown your way. And I think, again, I bring it around to JC, and I think a lot of JC's faith in you was the fact that you were willing to go to places that other investigators either couldn't, because it wouldn't have been sanctioned, or because you had the bravery to go to those places. And I think there were a lot of investigators that might have said, you know what, not my forte, and I don't think I'm willing to go that far. You know, I think it's out of the realm of possibility for me, or it's not, you know, I don't think I'm going to find what I'm looking for there. And you had very unconventional ways of stirring up potential leads, which is good. That's a good thing. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, you know, unconventional ways, that's probably the best way I've heard it described. And that's true. But I think that just comes from this unstoppable desire that I have to solve the case, to get that information out there so investigators can make an arrest. Because if it doesn't get done, I mean, then what? I mean, I just feel very strongly that every stone has to be unturned. And, you know, that's just something I've jumped in and done. And there's been, you know, negativity that's gone with that. You know, there's some criticism that comes with the work that I've done. And there's some danger that it's caused for me personally. You know, when you put yourself out there, your name and your face to any kind of murder case, you know, you're going to have a lot of negativity that comes with that. And so I've had to deal with that as well. And I've had to weigh, you know, the odds. What is this worth it to me? And it is, because her case has gone unsolved for 27 years. And I say not another day. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to continue to move forward until we've got the right pieces of the puzzle to put her killer behind bars. And I'm just, that's what I stay focused on. And it helps me deal with all the rest.
I do want to bring up one criticism, and I want to get your thoughts on it now that the book is out, and see what you think about it. The name Larry Swearingen. And now we should update people as to who he is and what his tie is to this case. Tell us a little bit about Larry Swearingen and his eventual fate, and why you think he may or may not have been tied in with Missy Witt.
Larry quickly became the number one suspect in Melissa's case, not immediately, but became the number one suspect about 4 or 5 years after her murder. You know, there's a lot of backstory, but, you know, just to get right to it, he was convicted for the murder of a 19-year-old girl in Conroe, Texas. Her name was Melissa Trotter. He kidnapped her from her community college. He drove her 60 miles away to the Sam Houston National Forest, where he strangled her and left her. And the crime is so similar to that of Melissa Witt. It's just uncanny. And the two girls looked a lot alike. But, you know, on top of the two crimes just being so eerily similar, you know, Swearingen has ties to Arkansas. His grandparents lived about 2 hours away from Fort Smith. Investigators in Fort Smith were able to tie him to Arkansas just days before Melissa's murder. So he was the number one suspect, because Texas was going to execute him, and they eventually did. There wasn't a lot of cooperation with law enforcement here, because they had their guy. And if, you know, it was their, you know, thinking that he was going to be executed anyway for the Trotter murder. So he'd had several stays of execution, I believe five. And in August of 2019, he was scheduled to be executed again. And I went on a campaign with the DA's office in Montgomery County. I was relentless. And they finally acquiesced to the request, and they invited investigators to come up and interview Swearingen, and he wouldn't talk to Fort Smith investigators, which leaves this huge question mark in the case because, you know, he was executed and he would never talk to us about Fort Smith or Melissa Witt. So he's still the number one suspect in Melissa's case. I've done everything I can to tie him to Fort Smith, Arkansas. Everything that you could imagine. If you ask me, I've probably done it. And we're just still lacking that connection to actually Fort Smith. But Swearingen and I didn't get along. We had a very, very volatile relationship. And, you know, I don't know if that hurt the case or not. It's been a criticism of how outspoken I've been about Swearingen in the Witt case.
Well, you have a lot of evidence there that would certainly point to the fact that he should be the number one suspect. There's a lot of, I don't want to say circumstantial evidence, but it's more than circumstantial evidence. He essentially did a copycat murder that he was convicted of in Texas with Melissa Trotter. I mean, you're certainly in the right to want to point the finger there. There's not, I mean, you know, you're standing on a mountain of evidence that suggests that he should be there and be the number one suspect as far as Melissa Witt's concerned. Wasn't there a receipt of some sort that was found?
Well, you know, at some point when I was very, you know, vocal on social media about Swearingen, I had so many people come forward, and someone came forward that doesn't want to be named that was part of the investigation. And they believed there was a receipt tying Swearingen to Fort Smith in December of 94. And I have tried to move heaven and earth to get that receipt, but if there was a receipt, it has been lost, which would have been our one tie to Fort Smith, which, you know, if we could get that, we could charge him. You know, he could be charged. Yes, he's already been executed for the Trotter murder, but, you know, we could bring some closure to this case. But, you know, there's a group of people that feel like I helped get him executed. You know, yesterday I got a death threat. You know, I continue to get death threats about Larry Swearingen. So I have no regrets. I did what I had to do, and unfortunately, we still don't have the information that we need, and he's still not cleared as a suspect. So we still just have a question mark when it comes to Larry Swearingen.
What baffles me is you're getting death threats, but he was executed for the death of Melissa Trotter. It has nothing to do with Missy Witt. So why are you receiving death threats?
I mean, if you Google Larry Swearingen's name, you know, there's going to be information that comes up that ties me to him. I mean, because I was outspoken, and I would write to Larry and he would respond back with a cease and desist. I mean, it was just, we had such a volatile relationship, but I was just determined to get answers from him. And I, you know, there's a group of people that believes that he didn't even kill Melissa Trotter, even though there's just overwhelming evidence to the contrary. But you know, those people are anti-death penalty as well. And anybody that has stood up against Swearingen has become, you know, public enemy number one. And, you know, I've received death threats. Usually it's through email. Sometimes they'll call me. Usually it's through Facebook Messenger. I mean, it's just been surreal. And I just deal with them one at a time. But people carry a grudge, unfortunately. And that's just part of the job, I have discovered, when you're on a quest for justice, unfortunately.
Now, you mentioned before, I'm going to wrap this into one really big question here, so bear with me, LaDonna. You had mentioned before a Mickey Mouse watch, and we have to mention to our audience, if they're saying Mickey Mouse watch, how does this fit in? Missy Witt was wearing a Mickey Mouse watch when she was abducted and then killed, which is one of the big, for lack of a better term, MacGuffins in the novel or book. So with that being said, there is a passage in the book where you were in a grocery store with your children, and you had put out a post on Facebook, I believe, on the Facebook page, asking people about Mickey Mouse watches. And a man approached you and your children in the grocery store. He was kind of a disheveled man, and he was following you and approached you with three older Mickey Mouse watches. And he was a scary sort, to say the least. So here you have people who are criticizing you and giving you death threats. You have the horrorcore community that's coming after you. You get the Swearingen camp. You have people following you around grocery stores. How do you keep it all together? I would be a puddle and a mess if I had that many people threatening my life.
You know, that day, and I get super emotional even talking about it. Boy, that really, it shook me to my core. I mean, it's one thing to receive a threat on email or a Facebook Messenger from a fake account or from a blocked number when they're not willing to give their name or say it to your face. Okay. I have to separate those things out to be able to cope with some of the things that have happened. But to have someone that had followed me for at least 2 hours that day when I was with my children and approach me and have the courage to approach me in a grocery store, that was just, I had to say, oh my goodness. I mean, I really struggled with whether I was going to be able to continue or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that was frightening. But, you know, something that my husband said to me really encouraged me was that here's some safety precautions we're going to take. And obviously I'm not going to share them because I don't want people to know what kind of safety measures we have in place. But you're already out there. You've already been out there, you know, for several years. People already know you, your name and your face. You know, they already know you. So quitting now doesn't make any sense. You've got to be brave and continue on.
Very true. Yeah.
And that brought me a lot of peace and determination. That one, that my husband was so supportive. And two, he was right. I can't go and hide anymore. I mean, I will never be able to hide. Like I get calls about other cases and get, you know, there's lots of creepy things that happen when you're this public in a murder case. So I had to take what he said and accept it, process it, and decide, you know what? I'm going to move forward. I'm going to move forward in such a way that makes a little bit more sense and keeps us all safe at the same time. So what's done is done. And I spoke at CrimeCon. I did a live podcast, you know, a couple weeks ago. And one of the things that I told everybody, and I want to say it here too, is, you know, think really long and hard. I really encourage people to advocate. If you've got missing people in your community or unsolved cases, and you feel like you can make a difference, even if it's sharing information on social media, it's important and critical, but I want you to think long and hard before you use your real name and likeness and go out and do something like what I've done, because this is not for everybody and it's not safe. And I don't want to pretend that it is. So I just caution people. At the same time, I also want to encourage people to be courageous and to dig deep and to do what is right, especially if they have information in a cold case and they're too scared to come forward. I think that's so important. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote the book the way that I did, very vulnerable and raw, because I want people to say, well, if she can be brave and vulnerable, so can I. And here's what I remember that somebody told me about the Witt case, or I know that my uncle has a woman's Mickey Mouse watch hidden in the attic, or whatever it is. And so that's, I want to inspire people to dig deep and find courage in whatever way that is, if that makes sense.
That makes complete sense. Are you finding now that more people are coming forward and wanting you to be an advocate for their missing people?
Yes. That has, you know, I've had some of that happen over the course of this investigation, you know, several hundred people. But what's happened now since the book has come out and it's been doing so well is that I've probably been contacted at this point by 900 families all across the United States, and it's overwhelming. And so I have helped co-found a nonprofit called All the Lost Girls, and many of those cases will filter into that nonprofit and help find them local advocates. And then with everybody else, obviously I can't help everybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm never going to be able to help another case on the level that I've helped Melissa, mm-hmm. right? This is 7 years of my life. Yeah. And so that's, you know, this is a once in a lifetime, you know, thing. But help find them other agencies and other advocates, you know, that are already established in their state or their community. And I feel really, really passionate about making sure that they at least get an answer from me on how they can do that. So I'm slowly, you know, answering those and kind of digging my way out of those emails and those Facebook messages.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you could say it's a calling of sorts. I guess and God bless you for taking that on. That's a huge amount of work. It's a huge amount of weight put on your shoulders, but I guess if anybody could take it on, it would be you. How do you feel all of this has changed your life? Has it changed it for the better? Has it changed it for the worse? How do you, when you look back on it now, how do you view this?
I think it's changed it for the better. I mean, even though there's scary things that happen, the ability to, advocate for someone that doesn't have a voice of their own is life-changing. And I wish everybody would do that, you know, to some degree, whatever that looks like in your life. You know, if that's, you know, advocating for kids in foster care, you know, like I've done, or advocating for, murder victims, you know, I think it is life-changing, and it takes the focus off of self, and it puts it back out on others. And I think that if there was more of that in our society, it would be a better place. I think if there were more advocates willing to come forward, even on the fraction of a level of what's been done in the Witt case, that we would see many more cases solved. Mm-hmm. And, I hope that it'll inspire other people, and maybe it will. And maybe, you know, I have had other people ask me, how can I become an advocate? And so, you know, I feel some responsibility of taking what J.C. Ryder has taught me and passing that on, you know, pay it forward. So there's going to be some more to come with that. I really feel like that what we've done, and it's not just me, I've got a team of people, you know, they just don't want to necessarily come forward with their, you know, their name and their likeness.
Right.
But, you know, if we can take what we've learned and kind of put that together so others can replicate it, I think that's pretty important. Cause we've learned a lot, everything from, you know, Facebook algorithms to, you know, investigating a cold case to passing your test to become a PI in the state of Arkansas. So there's a lot that we can teach other people. And so, you know, we plan to do that.
Last question for you, LaDonna, before we leave people today. And this is kind of a tough one. Is there such a thing as true justice for someone who's been murdered?
You know, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I spoke at an event a couple of days ago, and some members of Melissa Witt's family was there. And one of the things that we talked about was that, you know, even if the person who is responsible for this crime is brought to justice, that doesn't really bring Melissa back. It doesn't change the pain and the heartache that's been caused. Right. And so I think that there is no true justice in the sense for her. I mean, someone made a decision to take her life, and it ended abruptly, and we can't ever change that. But what we can do in her honor is to remember her well, is to advocate in her honor. It is to find who killed her and bring them to justice, prevent them from ever doing this to anybody else, and then to go forward with what we've learned and teach other young women how to be safe, and maybe be able to prevent this in the future. So there's no easy yes or no answer. I think that it's a little bit of both. There's still going to be a lot of sadness that's involved because her life was taken. Mm-hmm. But I think that there could be some peace to know that the person who felt entitled to take her life will spend the rest of their lives behind bars.
No,
and if I have anything to do with it, that's what's going to happen.
No easy answer, but that's a good answer, indeed. The name of the book is The Girl I Never Knew Who Killed Melissa Witt. LaDonna Humphrey is the author of that book, also an investigator and an advocate. And by the way, you can get that book by clicking on the link in the description of this program. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.